The trade war is off, it seems. For the moment, anyway. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Monday today. This one is the 21st of May. Glad, as always, to have you along, everybody. Chris Wallace got the scoop on Fox News on Sunday. Everybody talking trade war. Just hold on, all right?
Well, Chris, we're putting the trade war on hold.
Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin, of course, after 2 days of talks in Washington with the Chinese. We are going to take advantage of the pause to recap, to reset a little bit, and remember how we got from here on the 1st of March.
It'll be 25% for steel. It'll be 10% for aluminum.
To Treasury Secretary Mnuchin calling a truce yesterday. If you listened not even all that closely during the campaign, you know President Trump has some issues with the Chinese and their trade practices. Our trade deficit with Beijing in particular, about which more in a moment. But once the president imposed his tariffs, China did what you do in the early stages of a trade war. Jennifer Hillman's a professor of law at Georgetown.
It's imposed a series of tariffs on U.S. exports of a number of fruit and nut and wine and some limited number of steel products as well.
Then President Trump announced other tariffs in response to Chinese intellectual property theft and forced technology transfer, and the numbers started getting pretty big. $150 billion in proposed American tariffs on Chinese goods, $50 billion in Chinese tariffs on us. And then Treasury Secretary Mnuchin led a delegation to Beijing a couple of weeks ago.
And the number one thing on the United States' list was that there be a $200 billion reduction in the amount of the trade deficit that we're currently running with China. So the big emphasis was on the bilateral trade deficit between the United States and China.
Which gets us to yesterday, almost 11 and a half weeks total elapsed time. Jennifer Hillman, one more time.
I think what we've heard is that both sides agreed to basically that China would buy more U.S. agriculture and more energy products, so liquid gas and other things. So the promise that's been made is largely focused solely on this issue of the bilateral trade deficit between China and the United States, where it sounds like the United States is agreeing that they would take a deal in which China agrees to basically buy more U.S. product.
Which leaves a whole lot unsaid and unknown. And if I've said it once, I've said it a thousand times. Businesses hate that. Renee Bone is a professor of economics at the University of California, San Diego.
Business interests will be holding off investments. They will be holding off planned production until there is some more certainty around what tariffs will be implemented. This is clearly not ideal for either side.
All right, let me get you back to the president and his focus on the trade gap the United States has with Beijing and what this weekend's announcement might mean for it and for the economic long term. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has that one.
This morning, President Trump tweeted, China has agreed to buy massive amounts of additional farm agricultural products. Would be one of the best things to happen to our farmers in many years. Cornell economist Eswar Prasad is not impressed with what some characterize as a short-term win for old economy agriculture. Unresolved is China's push to dominate new economy technology.
All that the U.S. has gotten is promises that China will buy more agricultural products and energy, and that it will continue to discuss concerns that the U.S. has about its protection of intellectual property rights, access to its markets.
But China importing more food and fuel would at least reduce the U.S.-China trade deficit.
There's no upside in just reducing the trade deficit.
Derek Scissors is a trade expert at the American Enterprise Institute.
So the president sees it as an imbalance where we're losing money. I don't. The Chinese are taking our money and we're getting what they make. So I don't think a reduction in the trade deficit, even if it were to come out of this deal, would be a great accomplishment. But that's what the president promised, so politically it does matter.
Scissors predicts the trade deficit will rise again in a few years if deeper problems aren't addressed, specifically China's push to grow its high-tech and other advanced sectors using government subsidies and foreign technology. Jeffrey Schott at the Peterson Institute sees at least one silver lining.
While it didn't resolve any immediate problems, it did prevent the problems from getting bigger.
Schott says hundreds of billions in retaliatory tariffs would hurt both economies. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
There was a line in the White House statement this weekend about the current state of our trading relationship with Beijing that caught our eye. Both sides, it said, agreed to encourage two-way investments. That's interesting because both Congress and the White House have been making noises about how to limit Chinese investment in key parts of the American economy, technology specifically, things like mobile broadband and semiconductors. The push in Congress comes in the form of a bill called the Foreign Investment Risk Review Modernization Act, which could come up for a vote in the Senate Banking Committee tomorrow, and which would, if it passes, increase the scrutiny of foreign deals that have national security implications for the United States. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson explains what's going on there.
Back in 1975, Gerald Ford created a committee to oversee foreign investment in the U.S. His executive order was prompted in part by lots of oil money from places like Saudi Arabia and Iran buying up U.S. companies. But Matt Baltz at Bucknell University says for its first decade plus, the committee, known as CFIUS, didn't have much bite.
It met infrequently and didn't review many cases.
Until Congress passed a law in the late 80s that formalized its authority and review procedures. By then, Baltz says, a new country was prompting new worries.
Japanese firms, that was the big sort of competitive threat at that time to American industries, particularly high-tech industries.
Today, a different country, even bigger concerns.
The origins and even the details of this bill say China pretty much everywhere.
Stuart Baker is a partner with the law firm Steptoe & Johnson.
We have never had a peer competitor, an economy that was as big as ours, that was run by the government, and in particular, that could say, I want you to invest in the following 20 technologies so that we can catch up with the U.S. military lead.
Like, say, in robotics. The Senate bill's bipartisan co-sponsors want to give CFIUS new powers and new funding. It would oversee foreign investments in real estate near military facilities, for example, or deals that would expose sensitive data about U.S. citizens to foreign governments. Right now, CFIUS reviews only apply to deals where a foreign firm buys or takes control of a U.S. company. So this bill would also build on an existing export control process overseen by the Commerce Department to cover other types of deals, like joint ventures.
Yeah, that's the part I find most fascinating. They're looking at other situations.
Greg Hussisian chairs the international trade practice at Foley & Lardner.
By requiring a kind of licensing scheme, they can potentially slow down or block the transfer of very important economic and national security type of information.
Commerce already grants export licenses for dual-use technology, civilian tech that could also have military uses. This bill would add oversight of critical next-generation technology as well. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
So that's a lot, right? Long-term versus short-term thinking from Mitchell, the whole national security part of it from Tracy. What do you do with all the latest developments, though, if it's your bottom line on the line?
We're in a tough situation. We could either lose business or we may have to consider making product offshore.
Ty Taylor is the president of Greenfield Industries. That's a Chinese-owned manufacturer out of Seneca, South Carolina. His phone was ringing off the hook today. Everybody thinking those tariffs that, it seems at the moment anyway, are going to go away, were the ones he's been trying to get exempted from. They are not.
You know, we're a small company, and the amount of tariffs that we are projecting to pay this year is significantly greater than what my profit is in a year.
Taylor said he submitted nearly 1,200 exemption requests for all the various different products that he makes.
For probably 2, 3, 4 weeks, I had some of my best people spending 50% or more of their time doing nothing but getting our exemptions.
Commerce Department, by the way, has hired 13 extra people to read those 12,000 requests they have gotten so far. On Wall Street today, trade war? What trade war? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Some stories whip you around one day to the next. Hello, trade policy. Some stories are more like a slow drip. They take a good long while to play out. Back in October of 2015, a Wall Street Journal investigative reporter named John Carreyrou published a piece in which he detailed the lengths that a Silicon Valley company called Theranos had gone to deceive investors and its business partners, its employees, and members of its board as well, about the supposedly breakthrough medical technology invented by its founder, Elizabeth Holmes. I'm not giving anything away by saying that the device didn't work at all, but the details of how Holmes and Theranos went about their deception is amazing, and it's told in John Carreyrou's new book, which is called Bad Blood. John, it's good to have you on.
Thanks for having me.
Would you remind us what the, the supposed promise of Theranos was?
Yes, it was that Elizabeth Holmes, Theranos' founder, had invented a way to run the full range of laboratory tests off just a drop or two of blood. It would have been a big breakthrough had it been real. Thousands of scientists have been working on this for 15 or 20 years. And, you know, being able to run so many blood tests off just a tiny volume of blood is not a nut that anyone has cracked before.
Explain to me then what happened when she made the pitch to investors. I mean, she took one of these boxes, one of these machines, and plopped it on a table, and then what?
Right. Well, there was this VIP demo program where prospective investors and board members and also journalists would be invited into Theranos headquarters in Palo Alto and shown this black machine, this black box called the Mini Lab. Their finger would be pricked and the drop of blood would be placed in the machine, and then they would be ushered out and shown Theranos headquarters or a meet with Elizabeth in her office. And what would happen is as soon as they were out of the room, a Theranos technician would stop the machine, take the cartridge out, take the little blood sample out, and bring it to the lab where it was either tested on the bench or on the modified Siemens machines.
And there's a great scene where another reporter, and I apologize, I can't remember what he was from, but he sat around waiting for his results to come, looking at the thing, looking at the machine, and apparently Theranos had hacked the machine not to show an error code.
Right. That was Roger Parloff, yeah, the writer at Fortune magazine. He went to have a demo, and he was waiting around for 25 minutes, and the machine looked like it was going to take much longer. And so he had to go back to work, and it turned out that an app that Sonny Balwani, Elizabeth's boyfriend, who was the COO, ordered, built, had frozen the test. So it looked like the test was just taking place slowly. In fact, the machine inside had malfunctioned and the app had kicked in and showed that the test was taking a long time when, in fact, it should have showed an error.
How did it last so long then? Because let's remember, it's only, I think, this past January, right, that she settled a lot of the charges that you talk about in this book?
March.
But, yep. Right. So beginning of the year, right? So at least 12-ish, 13-ish years.
Right. I think one answer to that is that she and her boyfriend, Sonny Balwani, who was the number two executive at the company, really instituted a culture of fear and secrecy and intimidation at the company. They let it be known that company would have no problem suing employees if they spoke up, if they left and then spoke up. And so employees who knew that things weren't right usually left quietly. They were either fired or they left voluntarily, but they didn't speak up.
This probably will not amuse you at all, or frankly, your sources for this story that you reported in the journal. But honestly, the most amazing part of the book, once you get past how Theranos was being run, comes after you start reporting this story and some of the tactics that Elizabeth Holmes and the company and her lawyers used on you and the sources to intimidate you.
Right. It was something I'd never seen before. I've been a reporter for more than 20 years, and I've encountered some pushback. But this was essentially a scorched earth campaign to threaten and intimidate my sources and get them to recant. Theranos very likely hired private investigators to have several of my confidential sources followed after they figured out who they were. I may even have been followed. David Boies, the famous lawyer who was Theranos' outside counsel, came to our offices at the Journal twice to try to get us to kill the story. I had never seen something on that scale.
Has to be said here, though, that for a very long time, this company and Elizabeth Holmes got, you can only call it glowing treatment in the press, including in the Journal, we have to say.
Right. One of the things that I don't beat around the bush about is that the first mainstream publication that wrote about Elizabeth Holmes was the Wall Street Journal. It was the Wall Street Journal's editorial page in a piece in early September of 2013. She then used that story along with the fact that she was rolling out her blood tests in a few Walgreens stores to convince new investors. Then, of course, other publications jumped in on the bandwagon, such as Wired, Fortune magazine, which put her on its cover in June of 2014. And that was probably the piece and the cover that rocketed her to fame.
So step back for me for a minute here consider this, right? We are no strangers in this country to stories coming out of Silicon Valley of wunderkinds and the amazing next best thing and all of this. What does this story say about, first of all, how we treat Silicon Valley in this economy, but also the idea that there were regulators in theory all over this company, right? The FDA and all of that, and yet it still went on.
Right. I mean, one of the lessons is that we shouldn't lionize these young founders so much. We should keep, you know, a healthy dose of skepticism. There's certainly a lot of innovation going on in the Valley, but there's also a lot of pretending. And Theranos really was exhibit A of that. It was a fraud, but it was also a story of hubris and incompetence. And, you know, Elizabeth Holmes and her boyfriend, Sonny Balwani, were incredibly arrogant. And I think it was part of the reason that people believed in them and believed in her and invested.
John Carreyrou is an investigative reporter at The Wall Street Journal. His book about Theranos and that whole saga, which is amazing, is called Bad Blood, Secrets and Lies in a Silicon Valley Startup. John, thanks a lot.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having me.
Coming up.
I'm not sure where that is on the spectrum of who's paying attention to that right now.
On the low end, maybe? The scrap economy straight ahead, but first, let's do the numbers. Stocks jumped after the U.S. and China appeared to make some progress in trade talks. Dow Industrials up 1.2% today, 298 points, 25,013. S&P 500 closed up 0.7%, about 20 points, 2733. NASDAQ advanced about 0.5%, 39 points, 73.94. About that trade truce, by the way, American steel companies tumbled on the possibility of delayed American tariffs on Chinese steel. U.S. steel lost 3.8% today. AK steel down more than 5%. Steel Dynamics lopped off 0.7% today. Bonds rose. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note fell a fraction. 3.05% is the yield. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. The Supreme Court handed down a couple of rulings today. Of particular interest in these quarters was Epic Systems Corporation v. Lewis, in which the justices ruled that companies can force workers to use individual arbitration in resolving disputes, specifically arbitration agreements that say employees cannot participate in class action lawsuits. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has more on that one.
There are a couple of reasons businesses like one-on-one arbitration. Michael Weber is a partner at Littler Mendelsohn, which helps businesses write such agreements. For one thing, there's litigation cost.
It's exponentially higher to defend a class action in court versus an individual arbitration. It could be 10, it could be 100 times more expensive.
Another plus for companies, and possibly employees, according to Weber, arbitration proceedings are private.
Employers benefit from confidentiality because a false claim could have an adverse effect on a company, even though the allegations are not true.
But what about when the allegations are true? Elizabeth Wydra is with the Constitutional Accountability Center. She says if workers can't band together,
these small sum claims of wage theft or wage disparity will not be sufficiently lucrative to encourage those individual workers to go through all of the arbitration steps.
Several groups are particularly concerned about what this means for discrimination or harassment cases. Kaylee Gao is with the National Employment Law Project.
Workers want to be able to show a pattern or practice of discrimination. And if they're not able to bring their cases together, it's much harder to prove their case at all.
Gao says about 60 million workers are subject to such arbitration agreements, and with this ruling, she says that number is bound to go up. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
One more slice of the Sino-American trading relationship before we go. A company called CCIC North America, the China Certification and Inspection Group. It's got a fairly particular portfolio certifying for export to China America's scrap waste, specifically recyclable scrap. The thing is, since the 4th of May, Beijing hasn't cleared any U.S. scrap for import. The shutdown is supposed to last a month, which is a problem if your business is brokering scrap buying and selling. That's where Randy Goodman comes in. He is the executive vice president with Greenland America Scrap Brokers. Randy, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So when you got this news about China putting a moratorium, I guess, on scrap imports, what was your logistical position?
Well, to begin with, we probably had over 100 containers on the water moving towards China. About 60 or 70 of them are actually impacted.
Give me a dollar amount.
You know, best case scenario, $100,000. Worst case scenario, $500 million.
Wow.
Yeah, it's huge.
What happens if this does not get worked out and the Chinese, instead of lifting the moratorium on the 4th of June as they are supposed to do, say, you know, we're going to keep on going for a little while?
Well, at that point, decisions are going to have to be made. There's basically stuff is stuck in a couple different patterns. We're going to have to potentially relocate some or all of those containers to other countries, other buyers who do not necessarily have the same supply and demand as China. So you're looking at a marketplace that's already full and then lower prices.
Well, right. That's kind of the point. China is the biggest importer of our scrap, and whoever is not going to be able to take as much of it as you and we, I guess, have been accustomed to.
Definitely not. And even if you combine all the world's capacity for a lot of different items, they still can't take the enormous amount of scrap that China was taking and utilizing.
So what are you going to do?
Well, juggle. It's a lot of juggling to figure out where you're going to go with the scrap. And then the whole marketplace has some adjusting to do as to what the real value of those scrap items are, because the value is changing because a different economy is taking it into their mix and now has to evaluate at what price levels they want to buy that material at.
Do me a favor and complete the circle, if you would. This scrap goes to China. They turn it into products that, at least in part, wind up coming back here that American consumers want to buy at not really high prices. If this scrap doesn't wind up in that supply chain, what happens to American consumers and the stuff they want to buy?
Well, I think the obvious answer is they get more expensive. And that will happen. It already has happened in some cases almost immediately because certain items were not available for the manufacturers here in the United States to buy the normal material that they would normally buy as parts, whether it be parts of their manufacturing process or pieces of their equipment.
Given the news of the weekend that there is apparently some kind of detente here with the U.S. and the Chinese about global trade, are you confident that on the 4th of June, the Chinese will say, come on in?
No, I'm not confident at all, because this issue with CCIC North America is not just specifically related to the scrap metal recycling industry, but a large part of it is centered around the scrap industry. And yet that never really made a lot of the major media.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure where that is on the spectrum of who's paying attention to that right now.
And now you're on the major media, Randy. I'm going to point that out. I'm just saying.
Of course I am. You know what? But we're almost a month into this now.
Yep.
And the question is, who's jumping up and down for us as an industry to say, hey, wait a second. Yes, they're generating scrap, and scrap is a manufacturing part. It's pieces and stuff that's going back into the recycling chain to become raw materials.
Randy Goodman is the executive vice president of Greenland America. We got him in Atlanta, Georgia. Randy, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Hey, thanks a lot, Kai. I appreciate you listening.
This final note on the way out today, one of those, That's interesting. Economic tidbits. Fortune released its 64th annual Fortune 500 list this morning, the biggest companies in this economy ranked by revenue. Walmart's on top again, which isn't really news, but the good people at Quartz went back and checked their history books. Only three companies have ever been number one on that list in all the 64 years it's been around. Walmart, obviously, number one. Question for you, though, is which are the other two? Go ahead, take all the time you need. General Motors and Exxon. How about that? All right, we got to go. Wall Street was up today. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bonder, Sean McHenry, and Daisy Palacios. Our special projects desk is Tommy Andres and Haley Hirschman. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our Wealth and Poverty desk. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.